From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence make separate visits to New Hampshire. The ACLU challenges a state law that allows some absentee ballots to be thrown out because of a mismatch in the voter's signature. And on this crossover week, we are following lots of legislation that moved from one chamber to the other in the state capitol. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. And you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we are live streaming a video of this radio show, so it is very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and NHPR's news director, Dan Barrick. Hey, everybody. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Peter.
Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
So the phone number again for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And let's start by talking about the most recent notable visit from Vice President Pence. Vice President Pence was in the state yesterday headlining a fundraising dinner for the governor's reelection campaign. Some might say he is laying the groundwork for a possible Pence presidency someday. Dean, why might some say that? Why might some people say that about Pence's visit?
Well, because these kinds of fundraisers are often done in the closest large city. So he could have done this in Boston. In theory, it could have been done down in Washington, D.C., but he decided to come into New Hampshire, give the speech before the fundraiser, did an earlier America First event talking about the positive impact of tax cuts. The bill passed by the Trump administration. So, he talked up New Hampshire. He talked up Governor Sununu. Sununu had a very, very good turnout for his fundraiser, about 600 people at about $500 a plate, although for $2,500 you could do two people and a special photo opportunity with the vice president. So, it's about making connections. It's about being visible. It's about getting to know the people in the state should he decide to launch a campaign in 2024. We already know Trump is running for reelection, so he has that to look forward to. So New Hampshire will be important once again for him then. But, yeah, I think he's trying to, keep one foot in the state and get to know people better.
And, Dan, why might Pence's visit be good for Governor Sununu?
Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, one, he's up for re-election, and somebody like the vice president can help attract donors to a fundraiser. There's also the policy reality. There's a number of issues that the governor that are among the governor's priorities that a friendly face in the White House would be very useful. Not least of which is the other issue that brought President Trump here this week, the opioid crisis. Governor Sununu, I know we'll be talking about this later, has been one of several prominent New Hampshire officials who's been calling for a reassessment of how the feds dole out money to states dealing with the opioid crisis. Having a direct line of communication with someone like the VP is certainly useful in the governor's ability to lobby for that.
Yeah, and one thing to keep in mind with why Pence might want to come here is we all got to know Donald Trump very well through the whole battle in the New Hampshire primary, but Pence didn't come on to the ticket until the summer for the general election. So he doesn't have the depth of exposure and connections in the state that somebody like Trump does after running a full cycle through the presidential primary. So it really is an opportunity for him in some sense to introduce himself to local political organizers, Republican political elites, and start to make connections and, line things up should he decide to run in 2024. Most people expect that he will. But a lot of it depends on what happens to Trump in 2020. If you end up being on a losing presidential ticket, that can really really hurt your prospects. Think of Walter Mondale, for example, when he ran for president.
Yeah, and while he was here, Vice President Pence touted the recent tax overhaul bill, and he said the state of New Hampshire is benefiting from the Trump administration's policies.
The truth is, under the president's leadership and with your great governor, growth is back, confidence is back. And I stand before you today to tell you, America is back, and we are just getting started.
Just getting started. Dan Barrick.
Yeah, so there's actually a kind of a double-barreled visit for Pence. As you said, the first was this policy event where he talked about the tax cut. And I found it interesting that it was not sort of an open rally-type event. It was organized by an outside group that is a pro-Trump PAC. But Lauren Children, our political reporter, was at these events. And the other thing I thought was very interesting was she reported on what seemed to be a very genuine bond between Sununu and Pence. Sununu, in his remarks, said that when he first began thinking about running for governor a couple of years ago, one of the first people he reached out to him, I believe the governor said the first to actually get back to him was then Indiana Governor Mike Pence. So just in this, you know, this earlier point about the sort of, you know, realpolitik of this relationship, there does seem to be an actual, you know, sort of human connection between the two men, which also probably had a lot to do with yesterday's visit.
Right, and Sununu is a popular governor. It's certainly not going to hurt Pence to have a close relationship with him at this point. It was interesting. I saw a brief clip of an interview with Pence on television, and he was talking about Governor Sununu, and he clearly had been given very specific talking points about the things that Sununu had been doing in the state. He was well-briefed, and he kind of fed that back to the New Hampshire audience. So I think he sees it as a valuable thing. They may have a genuine connection. It may be political, but regardless, he realizes it makes sense for him to be here in New Hampshire rather than, say, do this in Boston or someplace convenient.
Well, and what could be a tough mid-year 2018
Absolutely.
Election year for Republicans. Sununu, you know, Sununu is the kind of guy that the national GOP would, you know, he's somebody they can point to. He's you know, right now at this point, obviously a lot can change. He's relatively popular across the board, and ensuring that he wins a solid re-election in a mid-year election cycle is certainly important for the national party.
And Pence is somebody who's viewed as a deep social conservative. Sununu has shown some crossover appeal with independents, and so that's not a bad thing either.
Listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. In a moment, we're going to be talking about President Trump's visit to New Hampshire. If you've got questions or comments about his visit, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to David in Keene. David, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Well, we heard Mr. Trump. He suggested death sentences for drug infractions, and Governor Sununu, I guess he's going to veto the repeal of the death penalty, from what he says, and it makes me question whether or not his allegiance is to win favor with the president or to New Hampshire. I'm so mad at him right now.
All right, David, thank you very much for the call. And just to add some context, while President Trump was here in Manchester earlier this week, he spoke publicly about getting tough, as he called it, on drug dealers.
We can have all the blue ribbon committees we want, but if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
President Trump advocating for the death penalty for people who deal drugs in New Hampshire. And to David's point, linking Sununu and his professed desire to veto a death penalty repeal seems like he's aligning pretty well with the president.
Well, I think there are two separate issues. I mean, first, the president's call for the death penalty for drug dealers. That's not an issue anyone really who's involved in the opioid crisis takes seriously. I can't see that happening. The response from folks here in the state was generally one that the emphasis should be on continued support for recovery and prevention and treatment, and some support for law enforcement. And the governor's, so that's, you know, sort of the president's position there on the drug dealers. The governor's statement that he would oppose a repeal of the death penalty, I think he's been consistent with that since the campaign. It's actually been the stance that every New Hampshire governor for the last 20 years, if not further, has taken. Governor Shaheen vetoed a death penalty repeal. Governor Lynch was opposed to a death penalty repeal. I could be wrong, actually. I don't recall Governor Hassan's position, but I don't think there's really any connection. I don't think Governor Sununu's position on that has anything to do at all with the President Trump's statement this week on related to drug dealers.
Ethan DeWitt.
And just something to clarify, what Trump is talking about, I spoke to people with the U.S. Department of Justice this week, and they were saying that this policy, that this ability to go after drug dealers with the death penalty already exists. There doesn't need to be any change. They can go after drug kingpins, and this is something that needs to be prosecuted by federal authorities. And so to an extent, it's a very different sphere than New Hampshire's death penalty and New Hampshire's authorities in this. This is something completely federally driven.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so there's fact and then there's perception. Even if it's not in fact linking specific policies here in New Hampshire to campaign rhetoric that the president seems to be using, is there not the danger for Governor Sununu to be perhaps unfairly linked to the president's unpopular policies?
It was really interesting to me listening to President Trump. You know, we've talked about the opioid crisis on the Roundup for several years now, 2-3 years. And we spent a lot of the early days talking about the conflict between the recovery community and the law enforcement community. Is this a law enforcement issue? Is it a recovery issue? And the whole process of dealing with the opioid crisis here in the state has been kind of reconciling the two positions and having them work in a complementary way. Safe stations is a good example with first responders. So as that debate has moved towards more of a cooperative and complementary relationship rather than a conflictual one between law enforcement and recovery, Trump's speech was very much old school war on drugs. He talked about immigration and gangs and criticized,
scary commercials.
Scaring people and attacked Lawrence, Massachusetts again, which has a very high Hispanic population. So a lot of people thought it was kind of a throwback, and it didn't really reflect, and I didn't necessarily expect it to reflect, the sort of long process that's been going on in the state of law enforcement and the recovery community figuring out how to work together. It went in had a very different feel to it, which is, I think, why Dan is saying that they're somewhat separate things.
Ethan.
I just wanted to add something that kind of got lost a little bit in with all the attention to the death penalty. The president, as part of his opioid plan, there was a fact sheet that was released to reporters the night before his speech in New Hampshire. It mentioned the death penalty against drug traffickers. It also said that the president's going to be pushing for legislation to reduce the threshold number of drugs to invoke mandatory minimum sentences. And I believe this is something that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is strongly in favor for. So they'll be pushing legislation that may have more of an effect in New Hampshire than pursuing the death penalty for these big kingpins, which cases are relatively rare. This would impose mandatory minimums that could include, you know, life imprisonment or long prison sentences for lower offenses. And so that could be more significant.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up on the show, a discussion about a variety of pieces of legislation, including Marcy's Law, paid family and medical leave, and abortion. Give us a call if you've got questions about legislation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Before we move on from the Trump administration, let's talk about one of its most vocal critics, and that's former New Hampshire Senator Gordon Humphrey. He wrote an opinion piece earlier this week outlining why he gave money to Democrat Connor Lamb's campaign in Pennsylvania. How does he explain this decision, Dan?
Well, Gordon Humphrey is a longtime Republican. He's actually left the party, but he has been, since Sir Donald Trump came on the scene a couple of years ago, has been one of the leaders of the national Never Trump, anti-Trump movement. He made an effort to lead at the RNC, the convention in 2016 to get Trump off of strip him of the nomination. It's sort of inconsistent in his larger sense that the national party has lost its bearings, that with few exceptions, in his words, party leaders sort of kowtow to Trump and his cult of personality. What I found actually the most interesting part of that was he had basically said he'd abandon any hope that a Republican could challenge Trump in a primary, and that the only hope for ousting him from reelection would be through an independent bid. And he threw out a bunch of names, some familiar, Kasich, Ben Sasse, Jeff Flake, two of whom, Jeff Flake was in the state last week. John Kasich will be in here in a couple weeks. I found that more interesting is that, you know, somebody, he's not exactly a party insider anymore. He's sort of been a long time since he's been in Washington and really been influential in party politics. But this notion that that the party had been so corrupted through its connection with Trump that any hope from the among conservatives would have to be from an independent candidate.
Hmm. And he also mentioned that any primary challenger to Trump is unlikely to win, but would do some damage to Trump.
Yes, a la Pat Buchanan, a la Eugene McCarthy. Yeah.
Okay, so not entirely a surprising thing to hear from Gordon Humphrey, in short.
Right.
Right, okay. A few more things to discuss before the break. Nothing to do with the president, at least not directly, but there is a federal grant totaling $333,000 heading for New Hampshire to fight the opioid crisis. Ethan, what would this money be doing?
Well, so the money looks to be used by Department of Health and Human Services to in part fund regional access point services, which is run by Granite Pathways. And what's interesting about this is that the DHHS has had some trouble with federal funds in the last 2 years. They seem to have gone through a lot of them. That they got some one-time grants, and then they've gone through them, and then they've had to make some cuts. One cut that they announced a while ago was a 50% cut to continuum of care coordinators, which is a really obscure position that's actually really important. These are people out in the communities who are helping decide how the state opioid money is actually getting to the communities. And those people were cut by 50%, the funding for their positions. So it'll be interesting to see as this opioid money comes in how DHHS uses that, given some of their challenges.
Mm-hmm. And Doreen Shockley with Granite Pathways, speaking about this money, says she doesn't feel it goes far enough.
$333,000 is better than no dollars, but I also know that that's not enough to do what needs to be done statewide for any program.
And what needs to be done, perhaps more funding for a variety of agencies, some of which are struggling financially in the state. Really quickly, Dan, tell us a little bit about some of the money that's coming New Hampshire's way or could be coming New Hampshire's way as part of the federal omnibus package.
Right. So this was another, I believe it's like about $140 million that is earmarked for states like New Hampshire that have a disproportionately high overdose and addiction rate. This has been something, we mentioned this earlier, that leaders in the state across the board have been calling for, that distributing money on a purely population-based doesn't reflect the reality and doesn't reflect the disproportionate burden that smaller states that like New Hampshire, like West Virginia. So, you had Senator Hassan on the air yesterday, and while folks like her and Senator Shaheen seem rightly pleased by this, there's a lot of uncertainty about how the money will be doled out, how much will be coming to New Hampshire's way, if there's actually going to set up another round of sort of competition among these states that have been urging this reallocation. So it's really unclear what it's going to mean on the bottom line for New Hampshire.
Yeah, just real quick, this is part of a bigger $3.3 billion that's been in the pipeline. Members of Congress have been working for a while now. People were looking to Trump's visit to have him say explicitly, we'll redo the formula for allocation. He did not do that. There's been some assurances that it is going to be recalibrated, but we don't know that for sure yet.
Okay. Two things to add on to that. One is that they didn't actually change the formula. What they have done is taken aside about $142 million for the states. And so you can decide that's a win for New Hampshire. There's a lot more money coming to us, but they didn't actually change the way this is funded in the way that the senators have been pushing for a while. Second thing is that the president just tweeted a few minutes ago that he may veto the entire spending bill on immigration concerns.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll have to stay on top of that story. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's news director Dan Barrick, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Call us now with your questions about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And it is crossover week, so we're going to be talking about a lot of pieces of legislation for the remainder of the show, especially within the next 20 minutes or so. So give us a call if you've got questions about bills working their way through the legislature, 1-800-892-6477. But let's start by talking about expanded Medicaid, because supporters of expanded Medicaid in New Hampshire were speaking out in favor of it at the legislature this week. Ethan, what were supporters saying about it?
Sure. So I just want to take a step back and kind of remind everyone that this passed the Senate already. It's now on to the House. And right now it's in the Health and Human Services Committee. One thing about that is that the House has traditionally been much more skeptical of Medicaid expansion in past votes. And so it's a bit more of an uphill climb for supporters. It's a lot easier in the Senate for the party. Obviously, it's a much smaller body. And so it's a lot easier for party leaders to kind of whip votes and get support behind something. The House is a lot more free thinking, independent. So there's some, that's sort of the backdrop. On Tuesday, there was a public hearing in the Health and Human Services Committee. And a lot of the same people, a lot of the same advocates came forward. But there were some new concerns now that the bill is sort of maturing along and it's progressing. Some of them were with the work requirement. This bill it puts in a work requirement, and some have found that it might be a bit prohibitive, and that it might not be flexible enough, and it might actually drive people who might qualify for Medicaid expansion now might prevent them from doing it. There's also been some concern with the way that the bill is funded, the way that the money flows, and basically they've changed they changed the program so that it moves on to Medicaid managed care, which is a different model than allowing all the people to be on the exchanges like private insurance. And when they did that, that means that there is, it's very complicated, but there are federal match amounts that go to hospitals, and those are much lower. And so basically hospitals may be getting a lot less when it comes to payouts from Medicaid under this new system. And the head of the hospital association has said that could result in a $35 million loss for hospitals annually. And this is something that hospitals are still behind this bill. Overall, it benefits them to have this high-risk population given health care. But it is a severe caveat that we'll see play out. New Hampshire's Medicaid match rate has been historically low, and this is something that nursing homes have dealt with for a while. It's been confined a lot to nursing homes now, and now it's going to be pushed to hospitals as well. So we'll see that develop.
And are we talking about 51,000 people who might lose it if it's not passed?
51,000 people right now are using the program, although the program has something over 100,000 people have in and out over its history used it.
Dean?
Yeah, and there's an important overlap we've talked about before with the opioid crisis. So number of folks who get benefits through the expanded Medicaid are also dealing with the opioid addiction issue. It's been an interesting issue to watch in the sense that, when Governor Sununu was running for election the first time, he was noncommittal about whether or not he would continue the program. I know that the work requirement was very important to Republicans in the state legislature. It's been a point of contention with Democrats, but my sense is that the whole debate has shifted to some extent, and I think it was the experience during the attempts by the Trump administration and Congress to repeal Obamacare. There was such an outcry over the loss of expanded Medicaid in states that had adopted it that I think Sununu kind of rethought his position on it. I think members of the state legislature, realized that, okay, there are these 50,000 plus people. There's a large number of people who are dealing with opioid addiction issues. Can't just take it away from them. So let's figure out how to do it in a way that everybody can be happy with it, shifting to the more traditional managed care method in the state. So my feel on this is that the whole debate has shifted, and it's less an issue now of whether or not that coverage is going to go away, and more of an issue of what's it going to look like in terms of work requirement, hospital contributions, things like that.
Speaking of Sununu, I just should point that one critical component of this, especially this year, is the negotiation with the federal government, with the Trump administration, which has to approve our plan. And that's something that the governor has been doing for the last few months. But it is still up in the air. We haven't had any confirmation that the agency, CMS, has actually signed off on our on everything in our plan. And they've said it will come in the next few weeks. That's a big question looming over this bill as it works its way through the House.
Okay. Another bill, or rather three bills to talk about this week. Three abortion-related bills failed to pass the House of Representatives. Ethan, tell us a little bit about those. What happened there? Or maybe I should ask you, Dan, about the...
They went down without too much ceremony. And some of them are sort of perennial bills favored by the pro-life community about outlawing abortion post-viability, mandating a waiting period before, for a woman seeking abortion. What's been interesting is, even in a first time in almost 20, or I guess about 15 years or so, that you've had unified Republican control in Concord between the governor's office, the House, and the Senate. Hop on social issues have really not been on the agenda. We've seen, cuts in business taxes, loosening of gun regulations. But the debate over, say, the transgender rights bill seems to be moving along without too much pushback from conservatives. And I think that this abortion, these abortion bills going down so with such relatively little debate, it just is also noteworthy. I mean, Governor Sununu has never been one to sort of get up on the pulpit and talk about these kinds of things. So that sort of came and went without too much fanfare.
Yeah. So safe to say that the New Hampshire state government right now is more fiscally conservative than socially conservative.
Yeah, and I think that's been the case for generations.
Right.
Yeah.
To some extent, it's a reflection of libertarian values in the state. Part of it is a function of what the governor and the legislative leaders want to put at the top of the agenda. We've had other social issues that have dominated in this cycle. I noted that the bill that was passed last night in Congress included the funding for Planned Parenthood. That has been kind of an ongoing issue. Conservatives want to block that. So, as Dan correctly mentioned, these bills are there every session. Bills are filed to deal with the issue, but kind of the focus of the country sort of comes and goes from it. And I think we're at a moment now where we're just focused on other issues. You look around the country, though, and there are plenty of state legislative debates over restrictions on abortion that play out every year in the country. So the issues, it's not gone, it's not going away, but I just think sort of right now people are focused elsewhere, attitudes are sort of slowly evolving, and there are just other things on the plate.
Ethan? I just want to bring in a sort of tangential issue that kind of speaks to this too. Access to contraceptives. There have been two bills passed on Wednesday and on Thursday, one in the Senate, one in the House, and they both passed very easily. The first one would require insurance companies provide 12 months of contraceptives. Right now, they're only required to provide 3. That can be difficult because people have to continually re-up their prescriptions. This way, you get a full year's, and so there's fewer lapses. And the House yesterday passed a bill that would allow pharmacists to prescribe contraceptives without the need for a doctor's visit. And this is something that advocates say is very important. There are, especially in low-income populations, the idea of needing to go to a doctor to get birth control can drive a lot of people away from getting it in the first place. And so getting it from your CVS with a certified pharmacist can help. What's notable about that bill is I was sort of on the House floor expecting there to be some sort of rousing debate. I knew that there had been opposition to it. There was none. It passed by voice vote. There was not a single bit of discussion on that. It sailed through. And so I think it speaks to what you guys have said about just sort of the mindset of the legislature when it comes to some of these social issues.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with our guest today about the week's news. Coming up, the ACLU challenges a law giving election officials the authority to toss out some absentee ballots if they believe there is a signature mismatch. Voters are not notified when this happens until after the fact. What do you think? Is this an appropriate law that guards against fraud, or does it throw out too many legit votes? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is also where you can watch a live video stream of our conversation. Ethan, I wanted to ask you about paid medical and family leave, because that bill passed through the House, but not without some attempts to modify it. So tell us about the drama that went on in the legislature this week with regard to the paid family and medical leave.
Okay, so just to set the stage, Representative Mary Guile of Concord, she's been working for 20 years for this program. This year it's gotten the farthest it ever has. Well, it's passed the House now, so it hadn't even passed a committee until this year. So obviously there's some sort of shifting opinions here. But her original plan would create a state-run insurance program to provide paid family leave. It was originally for 12 weeks of benefits. It got shortened to 6. And how this would work is every private employer would be required to offer this to employees, and every employee would be automatically signed up. They could opt out if they wanted to, but they would be automatically signed up, and 0.67% of their wages would go into this program. So this program would be administered by the Department of Employment Security. It does not exist right now. It would require a lot of startup. That's where it got some trouble. So it got through 2 votes in the House. They approved this program, but when it got to the Finance Committee, they had some serious concerns with both the startup cost and whether the program would be viable long term. If the program isn't viable long term, some on that committee argued, then you'd be promising these benefits without the ability to pay back. So in the last minute, they offered an amendment to change that plan to be a private insurance plan. It's actually very similar to what happened with Obamacare. So this plan would require that employers offer private insurance, but it would not include any sort of caps on how much employees would have to pay. So a vastly different plan, not a state-run program. That bill came up before the House yesterday, and the House overturned it, but quite narrowly, and went with the original version, and now it heads to the Senate.
Yeah, it would have been a huge change if they had adopted that amendment. I know that this business industry, I believe, opposed it because they said it would essentially be an employer mandate, and there isn't really a expansive private market for insurers to buy this kind of insurance if they were mandated to do that. So I think, you know, the bigger picture is family medical leave has been one of these things that both parties have talked in favor of. It was one, whenever you ask the Democrats or Republicans about areas of agreement in the last election, they would say family medical leave. But, you know, we see with some of the concerns that Governor Sununu has expressed about the funding it, that it's the devil is always in the details.
And I think, you know, this is going to the Senate now, and as you guys indicate, a lot of top Republicans, including the governor, have raised some real concerns with this. So I think the same kind of, you know, morphing that we saw in the House may well see that same process as this goes through the Senate. I mean, one interesting, just it you know, we talk about the policy and the politics, but it's always about the people too. And I just think you mentioned Representative Mary Stuart Guile, who's been in the House for a couple decades now. This has been her pet issue for years.
She said she ran on it. She got in office.
I live in her district, and every other fall she goes door to door like any good House member does. And she's got a little. She talks about this, and so I think it's just an interesting illustration of the power that even in a House of 400 members, individual advocacy by lawmakers about specific issues, you know, can still have a really big impact on the outcome.
Just to highlight a little bit of what was just said about kind of the challenges when it gets to the Senate. So you have 2 very different versions of the plan that have been proposed. One of them is that the state creates a program that doesn't exist, which the department estimates would take about $14 million at least to create. The other is that employers simply have to find private insurers to fill this need. The governor came out the day before the vote yesterday on Wednesday. He came out in support of the second plan, the idea of using private insurers, in strong support, and he heavily criticized the Democratic version. So you have 2 in a lot of ways, kind of irreconcilable visions for this bill. And as it heads the Senate, the governor, it'll be very interesting to see how they try to find some middle ground. And, you know, the governor wants family leave. He's a supporter of family leave, but he wants it in this version. And so it'll be interesting to see what senators do with that.
Mm-hmm. And we would be remiss if we didn't talk about another big piece of legislation in in the legislature, and that's Marcy's Law, a proposed amendment to the state constitution, in fact, that supporters say puts victims' rights on par with the rights of the people accused and convicted of crimes. That was debated. So, Ethan, tell us about Marcy's Law. How would it work as a constitutional amendment?
Sure. So I'll be honest, I'm not 100% familiar with the ins and outs, but essentially the idea is putting in the Constitution provisions that recognize victims' rights throughout court procedures and not just the rights of the accused, but putting the rights of the victims in set in stone.
And, yeah, that's correct. I mean, that's essentially it. It's basically putting in the Constitution protections for victims that are on par with protections with defendants. And it would be a change to the state constitution. So it's a very high threshold. You need 3/5 in both chambers. And we got that in the Senate. It was a 20-3 vote. And now it goes to the House. And then if it gets 3/5 in the House, you would still need 2/3 in November on a ballot question in order to alter the Constitution. And this is an interesting debate. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but there are lawyers on both sides of this. Some say it's necessary. Some victims' advocates say it's necessary. Other lawyers say that it's going to create a number of unintended consequences with legal proceedings. But this is part of a larger template that is going around the country. And I think we're only one of 15 states maybe that does not have it at this point. So there's a lot of sort of national pressure for the state to move forward with it.
Yeah, Jason Moon here at NHPR has done some really good reporting on that, the sort of national effort. I mean, it's largely been bankrolled by a California billionaire whose sister was murdered several years ago and has moved sort of methodically state by state to pass, you know, almost identical Marcy's Laws to state constitutions. Here, it's been a very coordinated, very sophisticated effort. The original language in the amendment was announced with a press conference that included the governor and the attorney general. They have hired a roster of lobbyists to push it through the state house. But I do think, you know, Jason's report and others have reported that many states that passed it in a similar atmosphere of sort of, you know, everybody pushing behind it, have raised concerns once it's in place, that there's been concerns that it has put burdens on local courthouses to notify victims in proceedings. The ACLU here has raised some concerns about that it may, in fact, infringe on due process rights for defendants. So there's still some. Getting it through the House Dean indicated it sailed through the Senate, or at least passed with a fairly wide margin. The House is always a slightly more difficult body. And I think just watching the campaign in the fall when this goes, if in fact this goes on the ballot, will be fascinating. We've never seen, I don't think we've ever seen in recent years, what will likely be a deep-pocketed campaign for a constitutional amendment here.
Constitutional amendment, big deal. All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and we're speaking with NHPR's News Director Dan Barrick, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website NH Political Capital, and Concord Monitor reporter Ethan DeWitt. Coming up after the break, we'll talk a little bit about ATVs and loaded guns, absentee ballots, St. Gobain. Lots of news this week. We'll talk about it with you, we hope. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email your questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, where you can watch a live video stream of this radio program. We'll be right back. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Dan Barrick, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Give us a call to join the conversation about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. So the New Hampshire House voted to allow people to carry loaded guns on ATVs, snowmobiles, and other off-highway recreational vehicles. I have never ridden an ATV. I could never imagine a situation where I would need that. But apparently there is one, right? You could need a gun while riding an ATV.
Porcupines.
That's why.
one of the speeches, the floor speeches, was a lawmaker describing the situation one of his constituents raised, that he's a farmer, he owns a big piece of property, and he's being harassed by vagrant porcupines, and that in order to deal with them, he needs to traverse large acreage, and the best way to do so is on an ATV.
Right.
And the method he uses to deal with these porcupines is a loaded shotgun. So you know, there you go. I mean,
and that was it. That's all the debate they needed. Is it? I don't ask that facetiously.
No, I mean,
was that it?
There was clearly more debate. That's the most picturesque image that came from it. But yeah,
I see. So, next step on that bill? Do we know?
I believe it's got to go to the. It's going head over to the Senate now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
This was not one. You know, this was sort of an under the radar one. But you know, it's you know, the one that we should talk about as well was the debate over. As it relates to the gun-free zones,
yeah.
But there's been a number of these. This whole issue has sort of been a little bit more charged. It's always a delicate one politically, but obviously the events of the last few weeks has created a real focal point for this in the State House. I know Ethan was there in the Senate yesterday over the debate over gun-free zones.
Yeah, Ethan, describe that debate for us.
Well, sure. So just to, set the stage, this is it's a last-minute amendment by Senator Martha Hennessy of Hanover. I think it kind of speaks to New Hampshire's political culture that it needed to be a last-minute amendment. I think in other states there might have already been some bill already in the work before the Parkland shooting. In New Hampshire's case, there are very few on the docket, very few gun control bills that were submitted last fall by either in the House or in the Senate. This one would have allowed this was an amendment onto a bill that was already there. So that's what sort of made it last minute. But it would have allowed for school boards to vote to make their schools gun-free zones. And basically, there's no state law that lets you do that. So in lieu of doing that, it would allow any school who wanted to do that. It would apply to their school grounds and to their school buses. The amendment was voted down in the Education Committee on party lines. And because it's not a bill, it doesn't naturally go forward. So it had to be introduced on the floor. And so it was a kind of a last minute, last ditch effort that it was sort of predictable where it was going. But it was the last piece of legislation to deal with gun control that existed in either the Senate or the House. And so it drew a lot of support. There were about two dozen local area high school students who showed up. They cut class with permission of their teachers. They showed up with signs kind of mirroring some of the national movement, and there was some passionate argument on both sides.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Martha Hennessy, who proposed that amendment, told WMUR that she put the blame for the defeat of the legislation on the influence of the NRA.
As long as people are being paid to vote a certain way, then why would they talk to the facts of the case? Instead, they're going to talk to their own best interests.
Ethan, so NRA influence here, is that what we're seeing?
Well, it that was mentioned there. I think one of the big strains of the debate where it was actually about sort of the idea of local control. There wasn't so much the NRA. You've seen it present in debate in kind of other legislatures. Here, it was more just kind of looking at Democrats argued that this was a necessary measure for local control, and Republicans were saying that it would create a patchwork system where you have one school has a gun-free zone and one school doesn't, and that it could create targets for certain would-be shooters to pick certain schools. Whereas if you have a whole state system, it's much more uniform. And there were some personal experiences on the floor on both sides that people were sharing anecdotes about children and to different arguments. You know, some said that their children said they'd rather have guns in school. It makes them feel more safe. And others said that banning guns from schools would help them move forward with peace of mind.
Dan?
And this wasn't purely an abstract debate. I mean, this has been played. This has been debated in school districts just in the last month or so here in New Hampshire. The Lebanon School District went through a process where they tried to vote to make their district a gun-free zone. Their own city attorney, district attorney, advised them that could not happen. Been a couple other districts that have bumped into this. There was an effort earlier this session by a Republican House member to actually enforce fines against school board members who try to declare their districts a gun-free zone. So this is not just a proxy for the larger national gun debate. This is actually a debate that individual school districts are having about how they want to police gun policy within their own schools.
But it is a core tenet of gun rights activists that the more properly armed, trained, and licensed individuals you have carrying, the less likely you are to have a mass casualty event. And President Trump has made the argument that when you label things gun-free zones, you're basically inviting a target on your back, so to speak, as people who want a mass casualty incident know that that's a place to go if it's a gun-free zone. So that's a core tenet of both NRA and gun rights activists.
And it's a pretty interesting political tactic by Democrats to try to turn what has long been a Republican tenet, especially in New Hampshire, local control, and turn it on its head. It was just a very different debate when you saw it on the Senate floor. Senator Bob Gaida said at one point that school boards are not competent to determine these issues. This should be determined by the legislature. And then I've had some gun rights people talk to me and say, well, the real local control is the individual's right to have guns. That's the real, if you want to put the real power to the individual citizen. So taking that away and per school by school is in some ways anti-local control. But it was just an interesting kind of inversion of the debate.
Mm-hmm. And although the state Senate voted down the gun-free school zone amendment, Senator Jeb Bradley noted a need for change in the state's approach to gun laws.
We need to be looking very actively at red flag legislation with appropriate due process criteria built into it.
So he's suggesting that a deeper dive be taken into this, but no more gun legislation up for debate this year, right, Ethan?
No. None in the direction of gun control, at least.
Ah, okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking about the week's news. Let's talk a little bit about absentee ballots, because this week the ACLU of New Hampshire is asking a federal judge to declare a state law unconstitutional. Essentially, the state's signature matching law allows absentee ballots to be rejected if officials believe the signatures on the ballot and the envelope don't match. Dan, the ACLU sued last year about this, so they're filing a brief now. What are they arguing, essentially?
Well, they're essentially arguing a few things. One, that the state's current policy of how it vets absentee ballot signatures disproportionately affects the elderly and the disabled. So you're right. They filed the original suit last year. They sent this week's brief in the case. They also was accompanied by what they say was significant research that showed that it was also applied indiscriminately or disproportionately community to community, that in certain communities up to, I think, 25% of absentee ballots were rejected for signatures, far less than others, so that it was unfairly applied, that the standard was not fair, and that it was not equitably applied across the state, either by community or by population. This will probably go to court. There hasn't really been a response, but it's also, it's sort of part of a larger debate around voting rights, ballot access that we've been having really for a few years now. The 2016 election and President Trump's subsequent comments about inaccurate claims about voter fraud here in New Hampshire and elsewhere have sort of stoked the flames. But there's just on a number of fronts this whole question of who gets the vote, who gets access to the ballot, and how does the state police that? And we've seen it also. I know you guys discussed this last week, but all of a sudden we've now got an actual competitive or apparently competitive race for Secretary of State, the office that actually oversees and regulates elections here in the state. So I think in another year, this question about absentee ballot signatures would probably be fairly not terribly newsworthy, but it's part of this larger question about how do we decide who gets to make a
and the various points in which we're entering this debate in New Hampshire, whether it's SB3 or HB 372. We could rattle off all the bills dealing with residency and domicile and absentee ballots, etc. This stuff in the end all ends up, it can be viewed in terms of civil rights and voting rights, and it ends up in federal court, and that's just been our experience with these kinds of things. In the end, the whichever side feels aggrieved ends up looking to the courts for some sort of relief. And that's basically what's happening with this.
And just to speak to kind of also talking about the new challenge to the Secretary of State's position, this is sort of a continuation of Bill Gardner's philosophy that the way to ensure New Hampshire's integrity and ensure New Hampshire's primacy when it comes to elections, especially first in the nation, is to kind of shore up these sorts of rules. He believes very strongly that the rules are there to ensure the elections. This is something that Democrats, though, are attacking him on from the left on a whole host of reasons. So things like this lawsuit provide potentially provide more ammunition for Democrats to try to use it against Gardner in support of Colin Van Ostern. But Gardner would say that this is just to ensure integrity.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking about the week's news. We've got a few more stories to discuss before the end of the hour, including Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics, which has signed a consent decree with the state promising to connect 300 more properties to clean public water supplies. That's after the company was accused of leaking chemicals known as perfluorochemicals, PFOA, PFOS, into the groundwater, contaminating wells. Dan, why is it a big deal that that Saint-Gobain signed this consent decree?
Well, the state environmental agency says it may be among the most significant in the state's history. It's significant for one. It will bring, I think, 300 more households onto public water supplies and allow them to actually, you know, run their taps in a way that, you know, the our reporter Annie Ropey reported on this. She talked to one woman who said she hasn't turned on her faucet in 2 years, and that the notion that you could just put a glass under a faucet and drink the water to her seems foreign. So for those folks, it may offer some degree of stability, but it's also it also just kind of keeps pushing down the road a little bit, this larger question about how do we set the standard for what is the safe, acceptable level for contaminants like this to be in groundwater, which is a debate that's been happening here in the state within the legislature, and trying to understand how New Hampshire's levels relate to federal and other state levels. But Saint-Gobain they've already paid to have, I believe, 400 something houses in the Bedford area. This would be another 300. So it's just a lot. It's just a lot of people who have been in this kind of limbo for a couple of years, who will hopefully get some degree of normalcy back in their lives.
Yeah. Apparently, this agreement also requires environmental monitoring, testing, potentially cleaning up more of the area. How long might this take, Dan?
It could take years. Saint-Gobain no longer operates there, but according to DES, the chemicals are still leaching into the ground from their former facility. So that's going to have to, you know, it's been this slow moving thing just to kind of get to this consent degree. But I think a lot of the remediation and the science still has yet to be implemented.
And they had already put on replaced 450 wells at some homes without the formal agreement.
Right.
So they've been moving in this direction
right.
slowly. And I think they're required to do all the hookups by 2019 at the latest.
Okay. Another story to discuss this week, the four Easter, apparently. We've been getting a lot of snow lately, and now the State Department of Transportation says it needs an infusion of about $4 million to keep the state's snow plowing and road maintenance budget solvent through the rest of the snow season. So, Ethan, it must have been a pretty bad snow season for the DOT.
Four is not the only, the $4 million isn't the only use of that number. It's apparently also the fourth most severe storm since they've been keeping records, the Department of Transportation, and it's the 11th snowiest. These kinds of requests are common after snowstorms. What generally happens is, according to the DOT commissioner, is they will use these funds to approximate how much the storms cost in cleanup. So the $4 million isn't going to go to make up for the funds. It's going to go to insure against future storms. And if it isn't used, it goes back into the highway fund.
Okay. Well, let's round out the show by talking about a couple of animal stories, because why not, right? Let's end on a nice, happy note. One of them has to do with Mac, the harp seal that was rescued in Hampton last month, returned to the sea on Sunday. Dan, how did we come to know about Mac?
I think he'd washed up in Hampton, I believe, after one of the nor'easters in February. Seemed to be not doing that well, and it was a rehab center, I believe, on the Cape that nursed him to health. and was released by the Seacoast Science Center folks this weekend. What I just kind of liked about the story was just how you realize the folks who work in this field, how they see the personality in these animals. They use words like chatty, and you know that they knew he was well when he was chatty again, which is right. You know, a way one might describe a baby, but also seems to apply to a seal. And that, you know, he was fit, fat, and ready for the wild, which is sort of, I guess, a nice descriptor that anyone would
we would all love to be fit, fat, ready for the wild this weekend. Yeah.
So that was a nice success story that end the week.
Okay, and last story we have to discuss. We just have to. I don't care what anybody says, including the producers of the show. Is Yogi the dog that someone described as a Shih Tzu that looks like Nicolas Cage dressed up as an Ewok? Did you see this?
Yeah, it's all over the place. It's a big internet meme, and social media is a buzz. And there are lots of I've seen lots of tweets where people are matching up various famous celebrities with the dog's face to see who looks like. I hadn't heard the Nicolas Cage one. There've been others out there as well, but it is a pretty it is a pretty eerie looking similarity, particularly the eyes and the mouth.
The lips. Uncanny. I think it's the lips that really sell it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here and talking about the week's news, including the Shih Tzu that looks like Nicolas Cage dressed up as an Ewok. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
That's Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Dan Barrick, News Director of NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Remember, you can find links to all these stories, including the one that has a picture of Yogi the Shih Tzu, at nhpr.org. And the conversation, of course, continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lort. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.